developments in the last decade in the United States after Donald Trump took office. And after the latest round of election in the U.S., the U.S. is no more in a position to preach other nations about democracy and human rights, especially after those confessions that Donald Trump made, and after the worst and brutal way of dealing with the protesters in the streets in the U.S. Capitol in Washington that continues even now today. Iranian public, especially the youth, have learned a lot.
We always hear the same words on Western mainstream media, like rigged elections, hardliners, or maybe fundamentalists. There are just few words that are used by the Western mainstream media. How is it hard for the Western public to view these serious news analysis that pass on Western mainstream media as actually pure propaganda against anyone who at least just have a different mindset of that of the United States of America?
Well, until 2 decades ago, it was really hard for the Americans to realize the realities because they lived in a glass house of the campaign. The information dissemination was done in a one-way road from the United States to abroad, while they never allowed others especially the alternative media like Press TV, Russia Today, CGTN, Al Jazeera, and others to do, to be free when it came to some certain topics dealing with what the United States didn't like. As a matter of fact, we entered this millennium in the last 2 decades, with the expansion of use of social media applications, this barrier is being removed. Mm-hmm. More and more people are learning about the realities on the ground. And although the United States continues to impose its hegemonic rule over the media in order to establish its own narrative of developments, in many cases false narrative, mm-hmm. Still Americans are learning. In the last war in Gaza, you saw that many Americans took to the streets in the United States as well as Canada and many capitals in Europe because they have come to realize and sense the reality gradually. I do believe that they are learning more about the facts on the ground through these social media platforms.
Well, this brings us to the upcoming JCPOA talks, if that's going to continue. That is, in his first speech as president, President Ibrahim Raisi said that he will be pledging to remove the U.S. sanctions to try and relieve the Iranian nation from these illegal economic sanctions. How do you see the JCPOA's future with such a statement on day one by the new president?
If the JCPOA is revived under President Rouhani, then it would be respected by President Raisi. Let's remember that it's the establishment that decides for macro-scale strategies, but the Iranian supreme leader, he is in the habit of giving free hand to all the governments. The same way he said he was pessimistic, but he gave the permission to Rouhani to go and deal with the United States through the JCPOA. If Raisi asks for a different road, then he would be allowed to do so. He has a complicated plan if the nuclear deal is not revived under President Rouhani. This doesn't mean that negotiations would be cut off, but it would mean that it wouldn't be as important as it was as a tool in diplomacy, a diplomatic tool, under President Rouhani, because mm-hmm. it was just negotiations under Rouhani. But now under Raisi, it's a more complicated issue. If the negotiation will be underway, but not as important as before, then a second step that goes in parallel is diffusing the U.S. sanctions through developing domestic economic potentials, expanding ties with the regional states, and also becoming a member of the global economic projects like the One Belt, One Road initiative of the Chinese, mm-hmm. the South-North Corridor or Indo-Eurasian Corridor, and also at the same time, Iran would go increase the leverage on the United States, not just through the nuclear capabilities or the military capabilities, but Iran has a wide array of options to increase the pressures.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mustafa Khoshesh for being with us. You are an Iranian affairs analyst with us from Tehran to discuss what are the prospects of the regional and international relations that are going to be tied again with the Islamic Republic of Iran after the election of the new president. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
As immigrant rights advocates have pointed out, the increases in the number of positive COVID-19 cases among the people detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement appear to be connected to ICE's refusal to systematically provide COVID-19 vaccines to the people in its custody. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Philip Do Lajos, writer. This article is published under the heading, Recent COVID-19 Spike in Immigration Detention Was a Problem of ICE's Own Making. Here's more. In May, as the number of people detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement began to swell, the number of positive COVID-19 cases shot up dramatically. On May 19th, the agency reported over 2,100 cases, a more than six-fold increase from the beginning of March, concentrated in detention facilities in Mississippi and Louisiana. As immigrant rights advocates have pointed out, the increases appear to be connected to ICE's refusal to systematically provide COVID-19 vaccines to the people in its custody. Even when vaccines are offered by state health departments, The Intercept has found detained people are not always taking them, sometimes due to skepticism of medical care in ICE custody, and sometimes due to detention officials' careless effort to inform people about the vaccine's availability. In addition, The Intercept has found that the increase in coronavirus cases coincided with ICE's decision to transfer detainees through a Mississippi facility where cases were exploding, effectively spreading the virus to various other detention centers in the South. Despite the fact that the agency has previously acknowledged in internal documents that such transfers cause outbreaks, transfers in and of themselves are high risk. Every time you travel by bus, by public transportation, with other people, there is a high risk of transmission and a high risk of being infected. especially if you're not tested and you are asymptomatically infected, said Dr. Ranit Misori, a professor at Georgetown University School of Medicine and senior medical advisor to Physicians for Human Rights, adding, "If I were running the IC medical operation, getting a vaccination program underway would be my absolute top choice." He said, as is everything with COVID, there is no one solution. From mid-March to mid-May, as President Joe Biden's administration began to allow more asylum seekers into the U.S., the number of people in IC detention grew from about 14,000 to 20,400, representing about a 45% increase. The number of confirmed active COVID-19 cases over the same period went from about 475 to 2,100, about a 340% increase. The Biden administration continues to expel most asylum seekers immediately upon their entry into the U.S. under an obscure public health rule called Title 42. Those who make it through are screened for infection. IC does not report infections among its staff, but there have long been indications that the staff bring the virus into detention centers, not the other way around. The loci of the outbreaks were in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Arizona, where IC has a robust detention infrastructure. The spread can also be tied to lagging vaccination rates as a whole. Louisiana ranks 48th out of 51 states, including Washington, D.C., while Mississippi is dead last, with about 28% of its adult population fully vaccinated. For months, ICE has refused to take responsibility for vaccinating people in its custody, punting the task to state and local officials, despite the fact that civil immigration detainees are inarguably in federal custody, even when held in local jails and private detention centers. As a result, vaccine offerings have been inconsistent across detention centers, including in the states where there was an outbreak last month. Ryan Gustin, a spokesperson for the private detention company Core Civic, said the company is working with ICE and the state health department to administer the vaccine, but did not address whether vaccines are currently being made available or how many have been administered so far. Spokesperson for the Louisiana Department of Health did not respond to questions, though people detained by ICE in the state told Intercept vaccines had been offered at various centers. The spokesperson for GEO Group, a private prison company that operates several centers in Louisiana, referred questions to IC and LaSalle Corrections, which runs two Louisiana immigration detention facilities, did not respond to questions. A regional spokesperson for IC also did not respond to questions. According to advocates, attorneys, and multiple people who passed through the Adams County Detention Center, the facility in Natchez, Mississippi, has been a stopping point for people brought in from the southern border and bound for other detention centers in the south, mostly Louisiana. The Immigration Enforcement Agency does not publicly report transfers between its facilities, but there are reasons to believe the COVID-19 spike originated at Adams and spread elsewhere in the region. At the end of April, ICE reported 232 cases at Adams, while the agency's other facilities in Mississippi and Louisiana were at 50 or less. By May 21st, the number of recorded cases at Adams was 415, more than any other ICE facility. and about a fifth of all acknowledged cases in ICE facilities nationwide. The Richwood Correctional Center in Monroe, Louisiana, had shot up to 196 cases, while the Jackson Parish Correctional Center in Monroe reached 86, and the South Louisiana ICE Processing Center hit 61. Rahman, who said he spent about a day at Adams before testing positive for COVID-19 and was transferred immediately to the River Correctional Center in Faraday, Louisiana, called Adams a trampoline from which asylum seekers were being bounced around. The Intercept is referring to Rahman and all others in IC custody by pseudonyms due to their fear of retaliation by detention officials. Several people who passed through Adams reported that they were given COVID-19 tests upon their arrival, but not always upon their exit or arrival at other centers. Rahman claimed that after he and four others were transferred to River with still active infections, they were put in isolation but left largely untreated.
Around the World with Reporters.
As anti-Westminster sentiment continues to rise, another part of Britain is entering the fight to break away from the UK. Cornwall, located on the southwest of the island, is witnessing the start of a new pro-independence advocacy group which aims to revive a lesser-known campaign for Cornish independence.
All Under One Banner's Kerr now is the latest branch in a wider organisation which already has roots in Scotland and Wales. In both countries, All Under One Banner has achieved significant success in opening up the debate on independence. Locals in Cornwall are hoping to achieve the same.
Many Cornish people who are recognised as a Celtic minority have various grievances with the English-centric London rule, including a lack of funding and a systematic destruction of an ancient culture.
That's a good way of explaining it. We're a long colonised place, possibly longer than the Welsh, who also probably feel that they've been colonised as well. But we've recovered that history, and that's one of our greatest successes. And the greatest challenge now is decolonising the history and explaining it to Anglo-Saxon ears.
In past campaigns, activists have been branded as nationalists who hate the English, a claim rejected by locals.
I've got no problem with the English or with any other nationality at all. What I have a problem with is the way that possibly we are represented through them, and the way sometimes we are talked down to and treated by them. But no, there's no problem at all. We have so many friends from all over the world down here.
For now, Cornish independence is a minority view, but lifelong campaigners believe things are changing.
I think we're already getting there in terms of greater autonomy, understanding the need for it. The next question is how to get it, and obviously there are political ways of getting it, but there's also a need for people to go out and campaign for it.
The idea of Scotland or Wales breaking away has sent shivers down Number 10. This latest development in Cornwall will surely only worsen Downing Street's fears. Robert Carter, London.
The US Justice Department committed a new flagrant violation of the freedom of the press and blocked several regional outlets' websites, including the Yemeni channel Al Masira and Iran's Press TV, claiming they are linked to what it calls Iranian disinformation efforts. Yemenis condemned this move, saying it proves that the US calls for freedom of speech are lies.
The seizure of some of the websites affiliated with the resistance front comes amid the media war. The Saudi-led coalition has been trying since the beginning of its war on Yemen to cover up its crimes committed against Yemenis and to mislead world public opinion.
Yemen's Ministry of Information said the U.S. government seizure of a few websites confirmed the strength of the media of the resistance and proved that these websites revealed the true face of the U.S., including its participation in the brutal Saudi war on Yemen.
We condemn the seizure of some websites affiliated with the resistance front. This move shows that these websites have been strong enough to influence the American public opinion by releasing the realities on the ground. It reveals the falsehood of American claims about democracy and freedom of speech. Certainly, there are solutions to this blocking and the websites will be running again.
Ali Ashrai, the manager of Al Masira website, said this move revealed the weakness of the U.S. even though it owns thousands of media outlets.
This step reveals the great weakness that the United States is suffering from, even though it owns thousands of websites, satellite channels, newspapers, and radio stations. However, it was unable to withstand a few channels with limited capabilities which convey the truth as it is and express the opinion of the free people in this world.
Experts believe that this step is part of a media war of the U.S. government against the media outlets of the resistance. They said these attacks will persist and the resistance access should be ready for further violations.
Yemenis say the freedom of speech is a fundamental right for all free people of the world, and the United States has no right to deny individuals or communities this right. They believe that such attacks will promote the free media outlets to continue exposing the U.S. policies. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A number of Palestinian prisoners are going on with an open-ended hunger strike to protest their illegal imprisonment without charge or trial under Israel's so-called administrative detention. At least three prisoners insist to continue their strike despite their seriously deteriorating condition until Israel releases them. Among them is 28-year-old Ghadanfar Abu Atwan, who has started his hunger strike almost 50 days ago. After starting his strike, Israel's prison authorities placed him in isolation. Later, he was transferred to Kaplan Medical Center south of Tel Aviv because of his serious illness, and he's being held there under detention.
Of course, when all doors are shut down in the face of the prisoners to get rid of the administrative detention, they have few means to protest and they have to engage in the hunger strike battle, especially that many prisoners' terms are renewed for several times and this without charge or trial. When Ghadanfar started his protest, he was beaten and tortured by the Israeli jailers and he was held in solitary confinement.
Palestinians held a protest in solidarity with the prisoners outside the Red Cross Committee building in Ramallah. The oldest of those taking part is 59-year-old, a senior leader of the Hamas movement, Jamal Tawil, joined in protest over the detention of his daughter, journalist Bushat Tawil. He's demanding Israeli authorities to release him and his daughter. Israeli court had extended Bushra's previous administrative detention order last March. There is also Sheikh Khadr Adnan, prominent leader of the jihad movement, whom is staging his fifth hunger strike. This is the 12th time he has been detained.
Today we are here not only to stand by the prisoners and support them. This is the least we can do against the administrative detention policy. Israel arrests people from all walks of life and different political spectrum. We are in real need to launch a national and worldwide campaign to force Israel to stop this policy that exposes the Israeli authorities and their illegal practices.
The Palestinian Prisoners Society said the Israeli authorities have lately increased the use of administrative detention against Palestinians. The committee said Israeli authorities issued 200 administrative detention orders since the beginning of May. The majority of the hunger-striking prisoners are those who are held arbitrarily under Israel's policy of administrative detention. That's why they put their lives on the line to demand not only their freedom, but an end to the administrative detention policy. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The
The U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea visited South Korea for talks with both his South Korean and Japanese counterparts. Sung Kim then repeated Washington's desire for dialogue with Pyongyang.
Most importantly, we reaffirmed our two countries' shared commitment to pursuing the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula through diplomacy and dialogue. We took note of the recent statement out of Pyongyang regarding their preparation for dialogue, and we hope to receive a positive response to our proposal for a meeting soon.
U.S. President Joe Biden's new point man on North Korea, however, conditioned any negotiations on U.S.-led sanctions against North Korea remaining in place, which many see as a barrier to kickstarting broader denuclearization talks. Some activists suggest the tension provides the U.S. an excuse to deploy troops to the region and support American weapons producers.
The importance of the Korean Peninsula has increased as the U.S. military pressure and response to China has been strengthened. The traditional diplomatic and security establishment of the U.S. wants to maintain a certain level of conflict on the Korean Peninsula.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last week told officials at a party meeting to be prepared for both dialogue and confrontation. Pyongyang later responded to Washington's offer of talks with ridicule, suggesting a wrong interpretation would lead to disappointment. The U.S. may be paying more attention to North Korea with the appointment of a special envoy in his five-day visit here to South Korea. The question is whether that will translate into greater flexibility from Washington in terms of offering Pyongyang some sanctions relief as North Korea deals with the COVID-19 pandemic and recent natural disasters. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In less than 2 months, Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi will take over power. And speculations over the fate of the 2015 nuclear deal is now the talk of the town, while there are still major sticking points in the Vienna talks over the revival of the accord. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said the discussions are likely to reach a conclusion before the end of President Hassan Rouhani's term in mid-August.
There is a good possibility that we will reach an agreement before the end of our tenure.
In his weekly briefing, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the U.S. is slowing down the process.
Iran and the U.S. still have differences over some of the issues. What's ahead is for the U.S. to make a political decision and lift the sanctions.
Reports coming out of Vienna suggest that the excessive demands of the U.S. and European parties to the deal are to blame for the sluggish talks. The U.S. wants the destruction of Iran's new generation centrifuges in exchange for only a temporary suspension of some of the anti-Iran sanctions, a demand beyond Iran's commitments under the accord. In his first presser as president-elect, Raisi made it clear that the U.S. must lift all sanctions before Tehran returns to its full compliance to the atomic accord. He said he will not allow the talks to become erosive.
The Americans violated the JCPOA and the Europeans did not comply with their commitments. The U.S. was obliged to remove all sanctions under the JCPOA, but it has failed to do so. The Americans should return and fulfill their commitments. I tell the Europeans not to be impacted by the pressure and the foreign policy of the Americans and to fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, the nuclear deal has been in limbo for 3 years, since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. In a tit-for-tat, Tehran adopted a stepwise suspension of its own nuclear commitments. The last remedial step involved ramping up the purity level of enriched uranium to 60%, way above the 3.67% cap set by the deal. The Iranian Foreign Ministry hopes the Vienna talks will conclude before Rouhani's term is over. Observers say this scenario is the best for the U.S., and any foot-dragging means the talks will have to continue with the new Iranian administration, which maintains a tougher tone toward the U.S. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The right to assemble, to demonstrate, to be heard by people in power, a cornerstone of democracy. Potentially under threat in proposed UK government legislation that gives the police sweeping new powers.
police now, for the first time, are going to have the ability to restrict static protests or even to ban static protests. Now, making too much noise is going to be regarded as something that could be problematic. There's also a provision in the bill for a new crime of creating a public nuisance, which has incredibly a prison sentence of up to 10 years attached to it.
And it was those provisions in the bill that got people out on the streets over the past year, not just in London, but up and down the country.
Parliamentary committee's warning echoes campaigners' concerns that the policing bill is deeply imbalanced. Apart from issuing unwarranted curbs such as noise limits on protests, they say, it does too little to protect women. That it metes out longer jail terms, let's say for vandalism, than it does for sexual assault.
The government response has been one of denial and defiance. Our proposed measures, it says, are in line with human rights legislation and in no way impinge on the right to protest.
There is no such thing as a protest that doesn't in some way impinge or disrupt other people in society. That's the point. That's the nature of protest. There's a kind of hostility to the very kind of philosophical notion and nature of protests right at the heart of this bill, and that's why we shouldn't believe it.
The contentious legislation came after protests by the Extinction Rebellion movement that first began in 2018 and last year's toppling of the statue of a slave trader in the southwestern city of Bristol during the BLM protests. The UK government has a majority in Parliament. It remains to be seen if the ongoing protests, the warning from the Committee on Human Rights, and concerns among some of its own libertarian MPs would prevent the draft legislation from becoming law. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Iran's AB Home and several lawyers have filed a complaint against Mölnlycke Healthcare, a Swedish medical device company, over its refusal to sell medical products to Tehran under U.S. pressures. Mölnlycke Healthcare refused to sell Iranian AB patients medical care items they needed, including Mepilex dressings. Several children in Iran who suffered from epidermolysis bullosa lost their lives due to the lack of urgently needed medical equipment, and some others were hurt by severe physical injuries, including amputation. Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening the international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has resulted in cutting Iranian patients' access to necessary medical items.
Since May 2018, that the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, up to May 2019, a number of children suffering from EB died only because they did not have Mepilex dressings. I want to tell those who claim to be defenders of human rights what has been the crime of this 37-day-old baby who died of the disease only because we did not have Mepilex dressings as a result of the U.S. sanctions.
The move has deprived EB patients, also known as butterfly patients, of essential medical items, killed many of them, especially children, and inflicted serious physical injuries, such as amputation, to some of the patients. The complaint seeks to protect the victims of the open violation of human rights committed by the Swedish company and prevent similar criminal measures.
The Iranian Center for International Criminal Law, an NGO based in The Hague, has submitted a complaint to the Swedish National Contact Point stating that the Swedish company had breached the OECD guidelines by failing to undertake appropriate human rights due diligence, adversely affecting the human rights of EB patients in Iran and failing to remedy its impact. The lawsuit calls on Swedish National Contact Point to hold the company accountable and take action to compensate for the losses Iranian EB patients have suffered and to resume trading with Iran.
Nearly 30 Iranian EB patients, mostly children, have died since Mölnlycke stopped selling its dressings to Iran, saying that for EB survivors, the pain has increased by 70%.
Iranian officials have repeatedly blasted the U.S. for imposing sanctions against the country, stressing that such inhumane sanctions have intensified the sufferings of kids with no access to special medicines for incurable diseases. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi has highlighted the principles of his government's foreign policy in his first news conference since his election last week. Raisi took a jab at the US and Europe for the failure to live up to their commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA.
The Americans violated the JCPOA and the Europeans did not comply with their commitments. The US was obliged to remove all sanctions under the JCPOA, but it has failed to do so. The Americans should return and fulfill their commitments. I tell the Europeans not to be impacted by the pressure and the foreign policy of the Americans and to fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA.
This comes as Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are engaged in talks in the Austrian capital to revive the accord, which has been hanging in the balance since former US President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew from it in 2018 and reimposed sanctions as part of his administration's maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. Raisi said his government will support negotiations that ensure Iran's national interests, but also made it clear that his foreign policy will not be limited to the nuclear pact.
Maximum pressure hasn't worked on our people, and so they must reconsider and return. Our people have shown that they resist pressures, and they must know that foreign policy of our administration does not start with the JCPOA and will not be limited to it either.
And this is how he responded to calls by some Western countries for including Iran's missile program in the Vienna talks to revive the JCPOA.
Iran's regional and missile programs are not negotiable. They have not fulfilled their commitments regarding issues that have already been negotiated and agreed upon. How can they enter into new discussions?
Raisi said his administration will focus on an expansive and balanced interaction with the world and would also be open to restoring ties with Saudi Arabia.
Ties with neighboring countries will be my administration's priority. With regard to ties with Saudi Arabia, there is no obstacle from the Iranian side to the reopening of embassies within the two countries.
Raisi also touched on the Saudi-led war on Yemen, calling for an immediate end to the conflict. Tehran has stressed that it seeks to establish ties with all countries based on mutual respect. Now it seems to be seen how Western and regional countries will deal with the new administration when Raisi takes office in August after he won over 60% of the vote in last week's election.
The week that saw British PM Boris Johnson's Conservative Party lose a previously safe parliamentary seat to the Liberal Democrats in a by-election northwest of London had another surprise in store. Former Parliament Speaker John Bercow changing allegiances and joining the opposition Labour Party and sharing harsh words about the Conservative Party and its leader.
If you believe, as I do, that this government is bad news, unfit to govern, and that the Prime Minister, though a successful campaigner, is a lousy governor.
The former Parliament Speaker went on to describe the Prime Minister as someone who has only a nodding acquaintance with the truth in a leap year, and complimented Labour leader Keir Starmer as an honest man.
His move to Labour signifies the sort of internal corruption and hostile and aggressive attitude, the return of the nasty party in terms of this current government.
John Bercow wasn't always anti-conservative. In fact, he started his career in 1997 as a self-described rabid right-winger and served as a conservative MP for 12 years, but says his political stripes have changed.
My values are left of center. I do not identify with the Conservative Party.
In 2009, he was elected as Parliament Speaker, a job he kept for the next 10 years. Although he kept his links with his former party, he wasn't very popular with the Conservative MPs, especially over Brexit. That led to the Prime Minister not putting his name forward for peerage. Bercow denies his pivot to Labour has anything to do with it.
Bercow's explanation of why he joined the Labour Party bears credence. The modern context of the Tory Party is one of corruption, one of regressive policy in very many areas, including international aid, one of cronyism at the highest level.
The UK Parliament's first Jewish former speaker also described the Conservative Party and its leader Boris Johnson as reactionary, populist, nationalistic, and sometimes even xenophobic.
Bercow insists that his pivot to the left is not personal against the Prime Minister, that he has reached a conclusion that the current government needs to be replaced, and that the only vehicle through which to achieve that objective is the Labour Party. Site for Rizza, London.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the all-compassionate, the all-merciful, salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad. Blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As a reminder, last Friday we started explanation of Surah Fath, the 48, in serial order of the compilation of the Noble Quran, and today we start from where we left you last week. Let us listen to Ayah 5 of Surah Fath.
ليدخل المؤمنين والمؤمنات جنات تجري من تحتها الأنهار خالدين فيها ويكفر عنهم سيئاتهم وكان ذلك عند الله فوزا عظيما.
That he may admit the faithful men and women into gardens with streams running in them to remain in them forever, and that he may absolve them of their misdeeds. That is a great success with Allah. If you might recall, last Friday, in our explanation of the previous ayah of this surah, we said that when the Prophet concluded the Treaty of Hudaybiyah with the pagan Arabs on being refused permission to enter Mecca for the Umrah pilgrimage, several of the Muslims felt sad in failing to go to the Holy Kaaba, in consequence of which God Almighty gave tidings of victory in the near future, thereby strengthening their faith and filling their hearts with tranquility. Thus, the one who puts trust in God never feels saddened, even in case of setback. or will not become proud and boastful in case of success, since everything is based on divine will. The ayah that we recited to you now means to say that the rewards of faith are indeed great, especially for men and women who have gone through ordeals to strengthen their belief and attain tranquility of heart. These divine favors include forgiveness of whatever misdeeds the penitents had previously committed, and their admission to the eternal bliss of paradise, where streams of various refreshments flow. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, though women are exempted from active fighting on the war fronts, their support of services and sacrifices of their menfolk will bring them the same rewards. Number two, faith not only prevents the believers from sins, but leads to forgiveness by God, the All-Merciful, of the sins they might have previously committed. And number three, salvation and true success, both during the transient life of the mortal world and the eternal bliss of the hereafter, are indeed divine favors for the true believers, in contrast to the perpetual anxiety coupled with lack of peace of mind and tranquility of heart that is the fate of even the wealthy disbelievers. Now let us listen to Ayah 6 of this surah.
ويعذب المنافقين والمنافقات والمشركين والمشركات الظانين بالله ظن السوء عليهم دائرة السوء وغضب الله عليهم ولعنهم وأعد لهم جهنم وساءت مصيرا.
That God may punish the hypocrites, whether men and women, and the polytheists, whether men and women, who entertain evil thoughts about Allah. For them shall be an adverse turn of fortune. Allah is wrathful with them, and He has cursed them and prepared for them hell, and it is an evil destination. Here both the hypocrites and the polytheists, whether male or female, are warned of the evil consequences of hypocrisy and idolatry, whose ultimate end is divine wrath and the fires of hell, which are indeed an evil destination even for those who doubt the promise of God. The All-Merciful Lord never afflicts any person with torment following repentance and seeking forgiveness of sins, unless such a person does not trust God and loses hope in divine favor. It is narrated that both the pagan Arabs of Mecca and some of the Muslims in Medina, who were hypocrites at heart, doubted God's assistance to the faithful and thought that the Prophet and the believers would never return safely. In short, those who rely upon God will attain divine mercy and ultimate victory, but those who do not strive in the way of God out of fear of enemies and hardships are cursed and face painful punishment. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, hypocrites and polytheists are always doubtful of divine promise, since they have no strong belief in the one and only God, hence their faith is interlinked. Number two, in Islam, which is the faith of all humanity, women and men, as the two poles of the society, are equal in both divine reward and divine punishment. And number three, there is no greater evil than to express doubts about Allah and His Prophet. since doubting is a disease that takes roots in the absence of tranquility at heart. Now let us listen to Ayah 7 of Surah Fatiha.
وَلِلَّهِ جُنُودُ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَكَانَ اللَّهُ عَزِيزًا حَكِيمًا.
To Allah belong the hosts of the heavens and the earth, and Allah is Almighty, All Wise. This blessed Ayah reiterates divine omnipotence and greatness. Divine attributes of omniscience and wisdom, consistent with divine mercy, are mentioned in the case of tidings to the believers. But when the reference is to the hypocrites and polytheists, divine attributes of omnipotence and wisdom are accompanied with warnings of divine torment. The hosts of the heaven and earth include angels and the phenomena of lightning, earthquakes, tempests, torrents, floods and landslides, as well as invisible forces that lie beyond human knowledge. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, all objects and phenomena in the universe are the creation of God and occur according to divine commandments. And number two, these hosts of heaven and the earth favor the believers and destroy the disbelievers. Let us now listen to ayahs 8 and 9 as the concluding ayahs of this episode.
Inna arsalnaka shahidan wa mubashiran wa nadhira litu'minu billahi wa rasulihi wa tu'azziruhu wa tuwaqqiruhu wa tusabbihuhu bukratan wa asila.
Indeed, we have sent you, O prophets, as a witness, a bearer of good news and a warner, that you, O Muslims, may have faith in Allah and His Prophet, and that you may support Him and revere Him, that is the Prophet, and that you may glorify Him, God Almighty, morning and evening. Ayah 8 addresses the Prophet of Islam and means to say that God Almighty has entrusted him with the universal mission of Islam to serve as a witness to the faith of the people, giving tidings of rewards to the believers and warning those in error of the consequences of their actions. If they fail to rectify their wrongs, repent and reform themselves. In other words, the Prophet is not only a testifier of Allah's oneness and supreme authority over the universe, but also a witness to the acceptance or rejection of the universal message of Islam entrusted to him by God. He gives glad tidings of Allah's grace and mercy to those who believe, submit to divine will, and obey God's commandments, while warning sinners, hypocrites, disbelievers, doubters, and deviators of the consequences of their evil. Ayah 9 addresses the Muslims and commands them to have firm faith in Allah and the Prophet. The Muslims are obliged to support the Prophet and honor him as a token of their obedience to God, the unseen but omnipresent, who should be glorified day and night. In other words, those with faith in the Prophet honor him and assist him and celebrate the glory of Allah day and night. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, the proper guidance of the people requires both tidings and warnings so that they neither become disappointed nor become proud and self-conceited. Number two, the preachers ought to be perfect practitioners of what they preach in order to serve as role models for the masses. Number three, faith in God requires supporting and safeguarding the sanctity and the status of religion and the person of the Prophet. And number four, a true believer, besides discharging his duties, whether social or religious, should spend part of morning and evening hours in remembrance of God in order to consolidate his bonds with the Almighty Creator.
Iran today.
There's a new face to Iran. Well, it was anticipated and it has been on TV quite a lot since 2019, but not as president. Seyed Ebrahim Raisi was announced president of the Islamic Republic a day after Friday elections on Saturday, June the 19th, 2021. Participation was under 50%, but over 61% of ballots were cast in Ayatollah Raisi's name. Looking at figures for the contestants trailing him, the win was by a landslide margin with over 17.9 million votes for the 61-year-old chief of the judiciary. Trailing him are Expediency Discernment Council Secretary Mohsen Rezai at 12% with over 3.4 million votes, former Central Bank of Iran Governor Abdel Nasser Hemmati at 8.5% or over 2.4 million votes, and Member of Parliament Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi at 3.5% with under a million votes. That's from a total of over 28.9 million votes, including voided blank or wrong votes of over 3.7 million or 12.8% of the total ballots cast. But I'm not here just to repeat facts and figures, but to analyze the results and study what Mr. Raisi might do with his win, bearing in mind his performance as top judge so far and what the nation is expecting of him. I'm Leila Faramayazi. Stay with me for this study on Iran Today. Before checking out the practicality of Raisi's presidential mottos, let's just see why voter turnout has been at its lowest since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. That's 48.8%, including invalid votes that I might add were more than the votes won by the second in line, Mohsen Rezai. For that, I give you Mr. Izadi, Professor of International Studies, specializing in Iran-America relations.
Iran historically has had more people coming up. Iran has been an outlier in that sense, that more people show up to the polls. And this time, it was less than Iran's normal rates. And the reason are two. One is COVID. Polling places are crowded. Some people are concerned about going to crowded places. And the second reason is because Rouhani, the people who voted for Mr. Rouhani, some of them did not come to the post.
All factors, causes and effects aside, the COVID-19 outbreak would have an unavoidable, uncontested effect on electoral participation anywhere, and by the most reliable findings. Based on data available from Harvard Dataverse, the French municipal elections were studied by Abdel Nouri. These elections took place at the very beginning of the ongoing pandemic and were held in over 9,000 municipalities on March the 15th, 2020. Turnout rates decreased to a